This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live. HRRN
Live. But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk, the show trainers listen to, all presented by Phasic Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, my producer Lee Della Pina, in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and I tell you every week, it's such a pleasure for me to visit with so many of the people that really make this sport go. And you know, I'm talking about the trainers, to hear their lives and their backgrounds and how they got into the game and some of the people that helped them along the way. So many different stories, some very similar, some completely different. And tonight we have quite a treat for you here on Trainer Talk. My guest this week has certainly made his mark on racing. He has recorded 3,120 victories to date. Those runners have earned more than $77 million in purses. Let's not short him about $50 million. In 2013, he led the nation's steeplechase trainers in earnings for an unprecedented 28th time and was inducted into the Racing Hall of Fame in 1990. He is a native of England and the son of a racing official. You could say that racing was always in his pedigree. And I now welcome Hall of Fame trainer Jonathan Shepherd to Trainer Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Jonathan, thanks so much for spending a little time.
No problem. Nice to be with you.
Yeah, happy to have you on board. And, you know, you've certainly come a long way since Half a Day gave you that first of more than 3,000 wins 48 years ago.
That's true. Funnily enough, I was just asked the other day in an interview, what was the biggest surprise of a horse that turned out well that we didn't have high expectations for? And funnily enough, I mentioned Half a Day. So it's funny you should bring his name up again today. He was my first winner, and he was basically supposed to be a hunter for my friend's wife, and he was not kind of unruly in the hunting field. And rather than admit he'd made a mistake buying an unsuitable horse, he said, "Well, we'll make a steeplechase timber horse out of him." And he became my first winner, and he also won the major steeplechase race in this country, the Maryland Hunt Cup, about 3 years later. So he was a champion, not a all-time champion, but he was a tough, hard-knocking little horse, and he kind of helped get me started.
Well, could you ever imagine when you were standing there in the winner's circle with Half a Day that it would lead to all of this and you would be where you are now in your Hall of Fame career?
Not at all. I feel very blessed, and obviously I've had a lot of help from a lot of good people along the way.
Yeah, and so much to talk about, so much to get to here, not just with your career, but with your life, and so many things have happened. You've had to overcome so much in your career. Let's start at the very beginning. What are some of your earliest memories of being exposed to racing, Jonathan?
Well, I grew up on a farm in England, not a horse farm, an agricultural farm, and kind of in the countryside, about 50 miles north of London. My parents had both ridden and fox hunted prior to World War II, when everything basically came to a screeching halt as far as the horse world is concerned. And there were a few retired fox hunters on the property, but really nobody was riding. The men folk were all off fighting, and the women were staying home raising the kids, one of which was me, of course. After the war, my older brother, when I say we, I very much followed in his footsteps as a youngster, acquired ponies and basically spent most of the time then we weren't in boarding school on our ponies in the winter fox hunting, in the summer going to horse shows, gymkhanas, whatever. And we lived in a little village, and there were a couple of other villages in the neighborhood where we had friends and who had ponies, and we'd often go over one morning and ride all afternoon and play games on horses and then spend the night and do the same thing and then come back the following day. So I kind of grew up with it. And wow. As you mentioned earlier, my father was a racing official. And so he actually worked out of our home. His main job was assessing weights for handicap races. He had to attend every race whose weights he was responsible for assigning. So he was usually 2 or 3 days a week gone at different racetracks. And but, you know, obviously I kind of looked up to my father, and he would often take me in school vacations to the tracks with him. And I became very much an aficionado from an early age, and the big name people in the sport were sort of heroes, and, you know, the top trainers and jockeys and whatnot, and the top horses. So I, you know, I had a passion for it pretty much from a very early age.
Did he encourage you to be involved in the sport, or was it the opposite?
Kind of neither, really. He sort of encouraged my interest, but I didn't think, as far as being professionally involved, I didn't think he thought it was very realistic. For one, it was not customary for a person with a background similar to mine to be a professional jockey.
Okay.
Amateurs, perhaps, yes, but, you know, that's not a way to make a living.
Mm-hmm.
And as far as training went, at that time, certainly in England, most of the trainers were independently wealthy people that had their own land, their own gallops, their own barns, yards, as they call them over there. And I didn't, you know, my family wasn't wealthy enough to be able to afford that. And on top of that, because of my father's position as a racing official, I actually wasn't allowed to have a trainer's license to train publicly so long as he was still working anyway. So it wasn't really an option.
Right, right. Did you ever consider another profession, or was racing always your true love from a very young age?
Well, it was my love, but thinking it was impractical, yes, I did. I actually was in the army for a short stint,
mm-hmm.
Which was probably a good thing for me, toughened me up a bit. And then I worked for about 3 years, I think, in a family firm on the stock exchange in London.
Okay.
I didn't have much aptitude. Didn't particularly enjoy it, and wasn't that happy there. So I was talking to, I sort of congregated with people with rather the same interest, or maybe I should say lack of interest, as myself, and we would sit around kind of complaining or commiserating the fact that we were there not by choice, but because we didn't have any other options, mostly because family connections or whatever. So this one guy who was an American was a very good friend of mine. One of my three or four of us shared an apartment, a flat, as they call it, over there together. He was American, and he said, you know, if you want to be a trainer and you can't train in England, have you ever thought about going somewhere else? I said, not really, but he said, well, you know, how about the States? I believe it's pretty big over there. I don't know a lot about it, but I've got a good friend whose father owns a racetrack up in New England, Suffolk Downs, the Tuckerman family. He said, you know, you might be worth taking a look around over there. So I asked my uncle, who was one of the senior partners in the firm, if I could have time off. He gave me a year's leave of absence. I was only 20 at the time. He said if I wanted to travel the world and explore other opportunities, he would hold my position for me for up to a year, but not beyond that time.
Wow.
I came over here and got lucky enough to meet up with these very nice family, the Burley Cox and his wife and kids, and they took me in as one of their own pretty much, and I've stayed with them as an amateur, riding races and helping in the barn, schooling and galloping and breezing and whatnot. And actually did go back at the end of the year, as I sort of promised I would, but didn't really settle back into it, and I contacted the Coxes and asked if I could come back on a more permanent basis, and they said that would be fine, and I came back, and I've been here ever since.
Well, you were always very ambitious, and you weren't afraid to go after what you wanted in this sport. Is it true that you wrote a letter to Princess Elizabeth, at least then Princess Elizabeth, when you were very young?
That is true, yes. sort of a trivia fact, but it's rather amusing. for a while there, I had my younger sister and I had a governess. In other words, kind of like a home tutoring. And I didn't show a great deal of, let's say, ambition as far as reading, writing, and arithmetic. So as a way to encourage me, knowing that I liked horses, she she suggested, we read in the paper one day that Princess Elizabeth had just had, she was not the queen at that time, her father still was king, but she was newly married, I can't remember how old, probably, you know, in her early 20s. And we read that she had won, owned a horse that had won a race, I believe it was on her birthday. In any event, with the encouragement of my governess, I wrote her a letter saying how excited I was for her winning this race on her birthday, and I'm very interested in horse racing because it's my ambition to become a jockey when I grow up. I was like 6 years old at the time.
Sure.
And amazingly enough, I received a letter back, not from her, but from her lady-in-waiting, saying her highness has instructed me to say how interested she is to hear it's your ambition to be a jockey when you grow up. Thank you for your kind letter. And so from a very early age, I evidently did have some aspirations. At that time, it was more sort of like a little kid's dream to be any sort of an important person in the racing scene. But as luck would have it, eventually it worked out that way.
Yeah, and who knew she would eventually, of course, become queen. But did you still have the letter that she sent back to you?
I do. Yes, I do, as a matter of fact.
Really? Really? Is it framed?
No, but I have it. They had a... it was some sort of milestone in my career. I think it was when I had won 1,000 steeplechase races. They had a little reception for me in Camden, South Carolina, before one of the race meets we have here. And they asked me to come up with as much memorabilia as I could, and I got a lot of old wind pictures and things, a few trophies. And I did bring this letter. I found it, and they kind of framed it and hung it on the wall along with this other stuff. So it's still around.
Wow.
And funnily enough, the lady who wrote it, signed it, Lady Alice Edgerton, who was Princess Elizabeth's lady-in-waiting at the time. I was just reading a book about some members of the royal family, and it mentioned her in the book. And they were—I remember that the letter that I received back was from Malta, which is an island in the Mediterranean, and they were on a sort of a state visit, a combination state visit vacation there, Princess Philip and Princess Elizabeth. And that's where the letter was sent to me from, and it mentioned that it mentioned her name again. First time I've seen her name since I received that letter, whatever, 65 years ago.
Wow. Wow, that's amazing. Talking with Hall of Fame trainer Jonathan Shepherd on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Jonathan, you leave England, I guess, around the age of 19. You come to America wanting to be a jockey. Take me through those early years and the trials that you went through in terms of trying to become a jockey and how that came about.
Well, my primary ambition, I never thought it was particularly realistic to be a jockey in a professional sense, you know, for a long period of time. My ultimate objective was always to be a trainer.
Mm-hmm.
But I liked riding, and I'd ridden in a few amateur races in England before I came out here. And I thought it would be a way to sort of make it a one, two, because I enjoyed it, and two, to make a little bit of a name for myself, to get exposure and meet people. And prior to going on to training, so that's pretty much what happened. I rode not with any great degree of success, but for 3 or 4 years. And then after I became married and started raising a family and realizing that I was never going to be a top steeplechase jockey, obviously I was too big to ride in flat races. I was sort of, maybe just on the fringe of the top 10, but didn't look like I was going to make it to the very top. Not very lucrative, quite dangerous, and not a very secure way to make a living to raise a family. So I figured it was about time to start into the training, realizing that it'll be a struggle the first few years financially, but thinking that if you're going to struggle a bit, you might as well do it while you're young and you don't have too many overheads. So that was sort of my game plan.
And you mentioned the name Burley Cox as somebody that was your one of your first mentors, I guess. Tell me about Burley and working with him.
I had a job for a short time exercising basically fox hunting horses for a family down in Maryland. And I, as much as I liked it, I explained I would prefer to be with race horses, and they had some contacts and introduced me to various trainer friends of theirs in the area. one of whom, none of that really panned out. And then they said, well, there is this nice family in Pennsylvania. We don't know them very well, but my daughter is actually friends with, their son was friends with the Cox's daughter. So through that contact, you could probably set up a meeting, which I did. I drove from Maryland up to Pennsylvania on a Sunday morning and spent got on a couple of horses in the Cox's training establishment there. Had lunch and chatted about it, and they hired me. So I spent the rest of that first year with them. And then, as I mentioned earlier, after I decided to pack up the stock exchange thing and then come back here more on a more permanent basis, I wrote to them and asked if they'd have me back, and they actually said they were good for, I think this was probably in the spring, they said they could use me. They wanted someone to stay and run the farm while they all went off to Saratoga and had a good time. So that was going to be my first job. But still, nevertheless, it showed that they trusted me to have some responsibility. But knowing that my job with them didn't really start till the end of July, I had a couple of months in between times. So I decided if I'm going to be a trainer, I might as well get as much experience as I can. And I just rode out exercise horses, basically, sort of as an amateur, with various different trainers in England, mostly steeplechase trainers. Then I was lucky enough to get a job as a pupil assistant to a trainer in Chantilly in Paris. I was there for about 2 months, which was, you know, interesting to see, understand the French racing and have a few contacts over there. And then I came over here and basically stayed here ever since.
Were those early years difficult when you were just getting started?
Yes, it was. It was sort of an uphill battle, to be honest.
What was your first big break?
I would say the first big break was probably getting this job at the Coxes, because mm-hmm. they were highly respected, very kind people. And as I say, they practically took me on as a member of their own family. And wherever they went, socially, they would take me along with them. And so I got to meet a lot of people. But I would say, and one of the people that I met through them was George Strawbridge, who, you know, became really my first owner. And from that day on has been my primary owner.
Yeah,
you know, the biggest owner, and he's been hugely supportive and very instrumental in the success that I've had.
Yeah, and still is to this day, correct?
Still with me today, yeah. I mean, he's got trainers in other places. Obviously, he's expanded, and he's, you know, got several trainers in Europe, and of course, Graham Motion trains, I think, probably about half the horses now in this country, and does well with them. He used to have a string in Canada, and he had a few in California, but he's dried, and he'll dry still. I'm not sure that he has any out there anymore, but he's been. I just happened to be lucky enough to meet him just as I trained the first horse he ever ran as an owner.
Wow.
You know, he was just thinking about sort of dipping his toe in the water, so to speak, and we started off with one horse and got another, and gradually, you know, after a couple of years, he said, "Why don't we go to Saratoga and get ourselves a couple of yearlings?" And he said, "I can spend $100,000, and you can buy two or three or four, you know, whatever, but we'll try not to go over that." And we ended up buying four, I believe, for $105,000. And one became a foundation broodmare. One was the son of Northern Dancer, who won several stakes and became a sort of a regional type, fairly successful stallion. And one is now in the Steeplechase Hall of Fame, Cafe Prince. And the fourth, who was the least expensive and not particularly fancy pedigree, both Strawbridge and his wife at that time rode quite successfully in steeplechase races themselves and, you know, proved his worth as well. So it turned out to be a pretty fortuitous foray into the bloodstock business.
Yeah, this is a day and age, Jonathan, in all sports where these types of long-term relationships are very rare. Why has this relationship with George Strawbridge lasted so long, and why has it been so successful?
Well, I think mutual trust and respect. You know, we sort of think along the same lines quite a bit. Even though I've obviously made a lot of mistakes along the way, I think they've always been honest mistakes, and I think he appreciates that. He's in a position, you know, fairly high profile, guy, a member of a, you know, wealthy family whose family owned a Campbell's Soup Company. So he's sort of a target for people basically trying to take advantage of him.
Yeah.
And a lot of the people that approach him with schemes and a way to make money or business deals and things are basically just, you know, con artists, so to speak. And obviously I was not that way and very careful with whatever money he and responsibilities he gave me. And I think we both rather enjoyed, you know, sort of starting at the bottom and working our way up. And as we went each step up the ladder, it would sort of cement our relationship that way.
I read somewhere that he was amazed that you do everything yourself and you do everything by hand. Even the billing is handwritten. And that really surprised him.
I feel rather embarrassed to admit that, but it is true. I'm kind of stubborn because I started off doing it that way, you know, when I had, you know, one owner and five horses or something, and then four owners and 10 horses, and I always did the billing myself, and it's true that I actually still do.
And
I kind of like doing it because it makes me think about each horse and each my relationship with that horse and the person that owns it.
Yeah.
And if you actually sit down and think about it for a moment on an individual basis, each time now I've got 130 horses or something and 25 different owners. It is rather time-consuming, but if I wasn't doing that, I'd probably be sitting around playing on my laptop or watching TV, so it keeps me out of trouble.
At what point did you decide to transition into training flat horses as well?
Quite early on. One of the first horses I had, who was supposed to be a steeplechase prospect, didn't pan out very well, and we ended up running it on the flat instead. And he did, you know, moderately well. And there was a trainer at that time, Mikey Smithick, who is a Hall of Fame member for steeplechasing, had pretty much a monopoly on the best horses and owners in steeplechasing.
Mm-hmm.
I think he was a leading trainer something like 12 times in 13 years, and it looked almost impossible for anyone to beat him. So now I'm looking at how much money the guy that was in second position behind Smithick, I saw his horses made, let's say, for sake of example, $75,000. I mean, that was back in those days. 10% of which is $7,500, which is the normal of the trainer's commission. And I'm thinking, how in the world am I ever going to be able to afford to buy property of my own and send my kids to nice schools and have the things I want if I'm making $7,500 a year? So it might be time to branch out. So I would say, as much as anything, it was for partially for the challenge, you know, to try to do another, to be successful in another branch of the sport, but I'd say more than that, really for financial reasons. Steeplechasing is a pretty small sport, and it's really not big enough for more than just a few people to make much of a living at it.
Yeah, which are more challenging to train, steeplechase horses or flat horses?
I think the steeplechases, you have perhaps a bit more input on the end result. You know, you can take a horse without really a great deal of ability and make it into something by training it really well and teaching it how to jump really well, whereas flat racing is a little bit more cut and dried. You know, you either have a horse that can run or you don't, and if you don't, there's not a heck of a lot you can do about it.
Yeah. Jonathan Shepherd, my special guest on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Jonathan, you talk about the dedication that you need to be successful. You hear this from a lot of trainers. You're basically married to the profession. And I had read somewhere where you said that that probably cost you a couple of marriages, being so dedicated.
I think, you know, if you had to put your finger on one thing, was regarding my first marriage. I was married for 14 years and had two children. I was sort of, to some extent, an absentee father and an absentee husband. So I'm on the road a lot, and even when I come home, I'm on the telephone or locking myself in my office, going through entry books and doing the billing that you mentioned and whatnot, and rather left the raising of the kids to my wife, which, you know, there's a balance, and it's hard to juggle the two together. And I think I probably fell a little bit short in that regard.
Well, divorce can certainly take its toll. I know I watched it with my parents, and it was very difficult on my father as he went through and tried to continue with his business. How difficult was that both personally and professionally, and how did you deal with it and overcome it?
It was extremely tough, actually, and I went through periods of self-doubt and wondering whether I was even, you know, doing the right thing. Even though my wife, certainly I gave her many good reasons for not wanting to stay with me. It was actually her idea, you know, in the final analysis, not for us not to stay together. And that was tough because that wasn't what I wanted. And then, you know, there were financial implications. I had to, quite a lot of my hard-earned money. We bought a property together, and I had sort of had to buy out her half of it. But, you know, I had a lot of help and support from friends. And believe it or not, even my wife's mother, my mother-in-law, she gave me a room in her house. She had a little couple of guest rooms up on the third floor. She said, you know, I basically started living at the racetrack. But she said, when you come back to the farm to look on the horses, if you want to spend the night, you know, you're welcome to stay there. So rather unusual that a divorcing man would be allowed to stay in his wife's mother's house, but still, she was always very supportive. She actually really was passionate, followed the horses. She used to love walking down to the stable and looking at the horses and talking to the guys working there, following them, and they ran, and did pretty much up till the day she died, which was, she died at the age of 92, just 3 or 4 years ago.
Wow, yeah, and just when you get past all of that and you're back on your feet, you marry for the second time, and your second marriage kind of was filled with tragedy, both with your wife and then with your son, who was killed in a fist fight in 2006. Look back on that for just a moment, and how hard was that to go through?
That was another tough, I mean, actually, to be honest, the divorce was, it wasn't really, it was more, to be truthful, it was more of a marriage of convenience, because Mary, who became my second wife, was really my girlfriend, and she became pregnant, and so we, you know, we wanted to make sure that the child was born legitimately, so to speak. But we never really lived together as man and wife. She was living with her mother, and I would visit her two or three times a week. She lived up in New Jersey near Princeton, and she had worked for me. That's when I first started dating her. But then by the time our child was first child was born, she wasn't, but we still obviously, you know, continued seeing each other. And so it was, you know, I don't think either of us really expected that we would be living as man and wife, you know, for a long period of time. So
yeah.
That part of it wasn't so hard. But and then she moved back to her mother, was diagnosed with terminal cancer. She wanted to move back to Kentucky because that's where her friends were and where she'd grown up. So when that happened, Mary went with her to look after her and took, you know, my children, two children, went with her. And so I really didn't see that much of them. I did keep in contact with them as much as possible and, you know, was financially supportive and would visit them whenever I was in the area. But it wasn't like we were all living together under the same roof as one big happy family.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
When he was killed, which he was actually on life support for over 2.5 weeks, so it wasn't like instantaneous. That was very, very tough. And I flew out there twice. He was in Denver, medevaced from Durango to a hospital in Denver, Colorado. And you know, the second time I went out there, I was pretty obvious, in spite of what the doctors told me, that he was never, not coming out of it. You know, he was in a coma, but he was, I just had the feeling that this was the last time I was going to see him. And I was stayed in his room with him for, you know, an hour or so, just him and me, really, and occasional nurse coming by. But he never opened his eyes or talked at all. And I think, and when eventually it was decided, family meeting pretty much to, and with the doctors involved, to remove life support, he died within something like 20 minutes. So obviously he was never going to make it on his own. And that was hard, and it was probably harder still on his younger brother, because mother died about the same time too. So all of a sudden he's got his two people he's closest to, his mother and his brother. Now they're both gone. And I think he felt a little bit mildly responsible, as people tend to do. You know, in both cases, maybe he should have stayed. The two of them had been out Halloween night downtown Durango, sort of parting it up a little bit, and the younger boy went home, and the one that was killed stayed out. And I think the younger one felt, you know, if he'd have stayed with him, maybe he could have prevented this. I don't know. But you always second-guess yourself in those kind of cases, I think.
Yeah. I'll continue my visit with trainer Jonathan Shepherd here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Stay tuned. The second half coming up next on HRN.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Fasig Tipton.
Where will you be this summer? The Fasig Tipton 2014 yearling sales will be here before we know it, so make plans now. The July sale in Lexington, Kentucky will be held July 14th. In 2013, the sale boasted an average of more than $89,000 and a median of $72,000, and the percentage rate of return of 43% was the third highest of any yearling sale in North America. The Saratoga sale on August 4th and 5th is always one of the top international yearling marketplaces. The sales $295,000 average in 2013 maintains its leadership role, and with the highest percentage of profitable yearlings among all sales in North America this past year, it's the only place to be this August. New York bred yearlings are in the spotlight August 9th and 10th in Saratoga, with a $430,000 average and major increases in both average and median in 2013. The New York bred sale is the most productive auction for the cream of the New York bred crop. So where will you be this summer? Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair strips' gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair strips.
It's time for a new type of wagering service. One that gives you cash back on every wager. One that provides outstanding customer service, where you can wager online or by phone with no fees on over 120 thoroughbred harness and greyhound tracks. It's time for BetPTC.com, racing's best kept secret. Join today and take advantage of our cash sign-up bonus. Then start earning cash back instantly on every wager you make. Join BetPTC.com and upgrade your wagering account today.
DerbyBox.com is the world's only full-time tour and travel company devoted predominantly to thoroughbred racing and the Kentucky Derby. A local Louisville area business since 1998, DerbyBox.com offers more than 25 years first-hand experience in Kentucky Derby travel and ticket packages. At DerbyBox.com, you'll find tickets and packages for every budget and taste, from Millionaire's Row to the infield. So don't delay. Book your trip to the 2014 Kentucky Derby today at DerbyBox.com. DerbyBox.com is in no way affiliated with Churchill Downs or Ticketmaster.
It's been more than a decade since Funnyside became the first New York bred to win the Kentucky Derby. Now, New York has two combatants hoping to follow in Funnyside's footsteps.
It's Samrat narrowly, and Samrat will stay undefeated.
So New York bred Samrat and his brave runner-up in both the Gotham and Wither Stakes, Uncle Cy, are both on the road to the Derby, while proving that New York breeders are increasingly breeding quality thoroughbreds that can compete across America and around the world. Learn more about our awards program at nybreds.com.
The history.
Coming to the wire, Seattle Smooth opens it to Florida.
The majesty.
Big Brown bounding home to a convincing win in the Run for the Roses.
The excitement.
Find that bird has won the Kentucky Derby. An impossible result here.
The most exciting 2 minutes in sports. The Kentucky Derby, Saturday, May 3rd, 5 to 7 p.m. Eastern, exclusively on HRRN.
Hi, my name is Alan Garcia.
My name is Paco Lopez.
This is Jose Lescano.
This is jockey Emma Jane Wilson, and you're listening to the Horse Racing Radio Network.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fezzik Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna visiting with Hall of Fame trainer Jonathan Shepherd here today. And if you missed any portion of the first half of the show, you can go back to our website, horseracingradio.net, and check out the podcast. It will be available shortly after this program here this evening. And, of course, you can listen at your leisure on your smartphone, your iPad, whatever it might be, and, of course, on your computer. It's all there for you at horseracingradio.net. Jonathan, so many things that you've had to overcome in your personal life to now get to where you are professionally. But let's go back to some of the big name horses that you've had the chance to be around in your career. And I want to start with a horse that a lot of people will probably forget began his career with you. And that's a horse by the name of Stormcat, who became synonymous with success in the breeding shed. Tell me about Stormcat and how that came about.
I received a phone call from Dr. Copeland. Robert Copeland, a prominent vet in Kentucky. He said there was he was doing some consulting work for a new person in the game, William T. Young from Lexington, who was just starting to race some horses. He was actually started off buying some brood mares and racing their offspring. His first crop, he only had, I think, two or three old enough to race, and he had sent them to Europe, where his daughter was living at the time. And anyway, they said they had this yearling on a farm in Pennsylvania that they wanted to send to Europe, but he was positive for EVA. And they were hoping that he would not test positive, indefinitely. He'd evidently been exposed to the disease at some point, but wasn't actually, he didn't have the disease, but he was a carrier. And they were not allowing horses into England at that time that tested positive. So they said, in the meantime, would I be interested in training the horse with a view to continuing to train him if his test didn't ever come down to the acceptable level to go to England. So I rather reluctantly, because I never heard of Mr. Young, and I really wasn't that crazy about taking on some horse that most likely I was going to just do a lot of hard work with, and it was going to be sent to some fancy trainer in England or France. But in any event, I did agree to do it, and the horse continued testing positive. So they left the horse with me. And the one thing that particularly swayed me to take him is that I remembered Stormcat's mother, Tulungua, who was by secretariat, and it was one of the first big-name horses that Wayne Lucas trained when he first switched from quarter horses to thoroughbreds. Mm-hmm. And she was extremely fast, two-year-old. And I had seen a photograph of her in the Blood Horse or some publication, and I just loved her conformation. This was how I was taught as a child that a really fast horse should look like. And and I was really intrigued to have something in my stable out of that mare. And Stormbird, his sire, was a top two-year-old in England, but then didn't train on well as a three-year-old. And to me, he was a little bit overhyped, and I wasn't sure how great a stallion he was going to be. Although it did turn out to be, he had a few really good horses. He wasn't a terribly top sire in a consistent way, perhaps, but he did turn out to be, a worthy stallion. In any event, when this horse came, I actually went over to the farm to look at him, and he was quite small, short little neck. It wasn't really a thoroughbred farm. He was being trained sort of in more like a show stable. He was just being broken, kind of jogging around a paddock. And he just didn't have sort of the muscle tone and the shape of a potential racehorse. But as I say, obviously I took the horse anyway, and shortly after we got him, I shipped him down to Camden, South Carolina, where we had the stable in the winter. And didn't show a whole lot originally, but by the time I got into the spring, all of a sudden, I'm seeing, a lot of talent. And he developed physically, too. He seemed to lengthen out and get taller. He was pretty hard to manage, but not really in a mean way. It was just a very good-feeling horse that would try to take advantage of his rider or his groom a little bit if he could get away with it. By the time we left Camden, I knew we had a pretty fast horse. And we took him to Delaware, and he trained well. I was in fairly close contact with Dr. Copeland, who was mostly my... I talked to Mr. Young, obviously, but Copeland is the one that mostly I kind of deferred to as far as plans for the horse.
Sure.
And it was proposed that Mr. Young would kind of like to have a runner in Saratoga if it was going to run any good and not embarrass us. So we took him up there, and sure enough, trained well. He was just narrowly beaten, running a little bit green in his first start, and then he came back and won. And then we went on and took him to a stake at Meadowlands, where he won. It was actually rather controversially DQ'd, but he showed a lot of talent. And then we ran back in Young America, which was a grade one at that time. He won again. Then we went to the Breeders' Cup, which was at Aqueduct that year, as the second running of the Breeders' Cup.
Yeah.
He lost by a nose, had the lead, and just lost focus a little bit. He was like a length and a half clear inside the last eighth. And just inside the last 16th or so, he just started to kind of wander a little bit, shorten the stride a little bit. I think it was more as much mental as physical. He probably hit the front a bit early. He was sitting behind two speed horses turning for home, and they both tired. And he was kind of a long stretch at Aqueduct, and he was, as I say, in front, probably just a tad early. And this horse comes blazing down the middle of the track, way out from him. And I don't think he even saw him coming and nailed him right on the line. Mr. Young always maintained that was the best photo finish he ever lost, because he wasn't really in the stallion business. He didn't even have a stallion shed on his farm, and Overbrook Farm it was called. And he really didn't particularly want to stand a horse there, and he tried to sell him. If he had won the Breeders' Cup, he would have been the champion two-year-old, and it's pretty easy to sell a champion. But because he lost by a nose, he was not champion. He was rated second or third best, I think, of his year. And my wife, who was quite friendly with Mr. Young and used to gallop the horse quite a bit at different times, she was chatting with Mr. Young about it when these offers failed to materialize. And he said, "What am I going to do now?" And she said, "Well, stand him yourself." He said, "Well, I don't even have a stallion barn." She said, "Well, you've got plenty of money, build one." So sure enough, as they say, the rest is history. He built the stallion barn and started breeding mares. He was, you know, sort of doing two for ones and giving his friend deals and whatnot to get him started. But as soon as that first crop came out, they came out running and kept right on going. An amazing, tremendous career he had.
Yeah, and you think about what he did in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile that year back in 85, and you are very well known, and rightfully so, for being unbelievable with your grass horses. But here's Stormcat, who comes along, and he's one of your early success stories, and he's one of the best dirt horses in the country.
No, it is kind of amazing, and that's, you know, I'm quite proud of that, because it shows that I'm not totally one-dimensional, and I think, you know, most trainers that... A lot of trainers tend to be pigeonholed a little bit as a turf trainer or dirt trainer or two-year-old trainer or whatever it might be. And, I think most of us trainers that might be in one of those categories feel, well, that's just happenstance, really. If you're either a good trainer or you're not, and if you can train long, you can train short, and if you can train fillies, you can train colts, and vice versa, and so on. And obviously, I'm qualified to train pretty much any type of horse. It just so happens that most of the horses I train are for owner breeders, and most of them are bred to go long on the grass, probably because I trained their mothers and their grandmothers, and they all run long on the grass. But, I mean, I guess to some extent, I think a trainer's runners, type of runners, a little bit is a reflection of their own sort of personality and style, and, you know, that would be probably the case with me. I'm sort of a patient person that's fairly quiet and doesn't like to, kind of like to take my time and let the horses develop naturally. And it's sort of against my natural instinct, I would say, to push a horse earlier too, before I think they're really quite physically or mentally ready for it. Although I realize that it's, that's a practical thing to do, and a lot of owners push trainers to do that, even though that may be not really what they want to do, but everyone sort of gets, particularly particularly new people in the game, they get carried away a little bit with the Derby and the Triple Crown, I think. And obviously, you've got to push horses at two if you're going to have them run well in the spring of the 3-year-old years.
Yeah, has it been tempting not to fall into that pattern with the way that we put so much emphasis on precocious runners in this game now and winning early and being fast? Have you had to fight yourself to not fall into that, Jonathan?
Not really, because I think it's, basically what I think my primary objective as a trainer is to try to please my owners.
Yep.
If I had an owner who says that, the only thing they're interested in is winning the Kentucky Derby, I would train their horses differently. But most of my owners either leave me to my own devices or they aren't, that's not their first priority either. So it's not really, that's not really a question for me, I wouldn't say. I mean, I think that it is obviously an omission on my resume, that I haven't had a Triple Crown contender, and it would be a fun thing to do. And hopefully it could happen before too late.
Well, your philosophy has always been that the horses come first. And, obviously that's true in the way that you train and your clients that you have involved with you. And I think that's why they stay with you for so long, like George Strawbridge. Graham Motion always tells me that he attended the school of Jonathan Shepherd. He was your assistant. What does that mean to you, knowing that he's never forgotten?
Well, I'm very happy for Graham. I'm very proud of what he's accomplished. And it's nice that he would recognize that I've had an influence on what he's done. But in the final analysis, it's still up to him. It's up to the person. But I think he saw the best of both sides, because he was lucky enough to spend his 3 or 4 years with me, which was the first job he had in racing, and see the way that I do things. And then he was with a trainer who was almost exactly the opposite. He specialized in early two-year-olds, Bernie Bond.
Mm-hmm.
So he was able to, I guess, to see, the best of both worlds and pick out the things that he thought appealed to him and what might work for him and make a go of it. And obviously he's done extremely well.
Yeah, I know it's probably...
I like to see him... I like to see him do well, and I feel proud of if I could have had a little bit of an influence on what he's achieved.
Yeah, it has to be very rewarding for you when you see Graham or any of your former assistants go out and do well and have success, knowing that you're somewhat of a proud father. You've helped get them to that point.
The only thing I don't like is when they keep beating me. Because that same thing happened with, obviously, Graham and I tend to, we'll often have runners in the same type races. And I would say at this point he probably beats me more often than I beat him, although, we've had our moments too. Same thing happened actually with Janet Elliott, the steeplechase trainer, who's actually now in the Hall of Fame. She was with me for 7 or 8 years when she first came to this country from Ireland. And a little bit as Wayne Lucas said, not only did she, when she went out on her own, with my encouragement and endorsement, one or two of my owners kind of gravitated towards her too. I think they thought, well, Shepherd, he's got so many horses, he hardly ever even shows up at the races, at the steeplechase races, because he's always off in some flat track somewhere. And here's a person that's got a small stable, got lots of individual attention, trains just the same as him because she was with him for so many years. And the one guy told me, he said, I always used to go to the races and see my horses run, and you're my trainer, and it's Janet, so always the one sat on the horse, and you're leaving there. So, she's had a very remarkable career, too. She started pretty much from nothing, and has done awfully well.
How excited were you the day that Graham won the Kentucky Derby?
Oh, it was unbelievable. I mean, obviously, that's sort of the pinnacle for everybody. And I was actually there... Barclay Tagg worked for me, but only for quite a short time when he was riding steeplechase races. He was with me for about 2 years. And he won the Kentucky Derby before Graham did. I was actually there that day. There was sort of a Churchill Downs, it's hard to get seating, obviously, for the Derby, but they have kind of a little trainer's stand near the finish line.
Mm-hmm.
You can't see much because it's practically at ground level, but... my wife and I were there. We had a run in the previous race, I think, with anticipation, and we stayed to watch the Derby. And I was probably the first person to step to give Barkley a high five as he sort of clambered over the seats trying to run to the winner's circle. So it's I don't consider I probably had a great deal of influence on his training philosophy, but as he spent some time with Frank Whiteley after he left me, and I think one or two other people. But so I've been, and then I was a little bit of a mentor, I think, to Michael Matz when he first started.
Sure.
Because he was a neighbor and a friend, and he used to ask me advice and about things when he first started. So to some extent, I've been, you know, fairly on a fairly personal level involved with three different people that have won the Derby.
Well, and you're one of only two trainers to win Eclipse Awards for both flat racing and steeplechasing. What goes through your mind when you hear something like that, Jonathan?
Well, obviously that makes me very proud. I think it's, you know, an Eclipse Award is, you know, sort of the ultimate goal for everybody in racing, I think. In whatever category, and to be able to demonstrate one's versatility by doing it in, you know, more than one branch gives me a great deal of satisfaction. And I'm particularly proud of the fact that we actually had an Eclipse Award for champion dirt, female dirt sprinter. I'm not known as a dirt trainer. I'm not known as a trainer of sprinters. Informed Decision got the Eclipse Award for the champion female sprinter. So it was, you know, I'm quite proud of that too.
Yeah, it comes back to the versatility that you talked about earlier and not being pigeonholed as just a turf distance type of trainer. Look back on that day in 1990 when you get the news that you're going to be inducted into racing's Hall of Fame. It had to be just amazing for you.
I had been put up a year or two before. I still have a kind of, what would you call it, kind of a document that they send you.
Mm-hmm.
I don't quite know why, because actually I wasn't even qualified, because you have to train for 25 or more years, I think, before you're eligible. And this was, I think I, well, let's see, 1966, let me see. Yeah, I don't think I was even eligible the first year, but I was, on the ballot, but didn't make the cut, so to speak, one or two years earlier. So I kind of knew that it could happen, I suppose. I was surprised, because I don't really have a particularly big ego, and it always sort of amazes me to think that I've accomplished what I have, because I don't really think of myself as being, you know, that kind of important a person. But, you know, I was extremely proud. It was great. You know, I contacted my parents, and they didn't really know what it meant exactly, but I tried to explain it. I think they were pretty appreciative of it all.
They didn't know what it meant that you got into the Hall of Fame?
Well, yeah, they did. They did, but it's not quite the same thing, because I never even been to the States.
Right.
I don't think they know quite what the connotations are. It was... You know, it was. I guess when you achieve any success, you tend to rather. You want your parents to be proud of you, you know, all the time when you're growing up and when you get started. And I felt that I was sort of sharing it with them to some extent, and they were partially responsible for my being there.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure when you get the kind of news that you're inducted into the Hall of Fame, it's somewhat of a career, I won't call it a lifetime achievement award, because you've trained several winners since that day in 1990, but a career achievement award, and to be recognized by the industry that you've devoted so much time to has to be special. I'm sure you did your share of reflecting on your career at that point, and I'm just curious as to what some of the names are. Like, when you look back now and you get a few minutes to sit alone and it's just Jonathan Shepherd, and you think about what you've accomplished, Jonathan, from that day when you first started in England, What are some of the names, human, equine, that kind of pop into your head that you're never going to forget that helped you get to this point?
That's a pretty tough question, because there's been so many.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel, I've always felt that I'm sort of just part of a team. So all the people that have worked with me at the different times, and it's often been, you know, obviously they don't stay forever and leave for different reasons, and you always wonder how you're going to manage to keep going when key people leave. But I have somehow, and you know, I it makes you realize that you must have some sort of intestinal fortitude or whatever to keep going, you know, and still be consistent at a relatively high level. But I do feel that even though the people have changed, the names have changed, it's still, I've always had help from and support from people and from horses. I mean, the owner's Bill Paper's been with me just a year or two less than George Strawbridge. He probably started with me in Strawbridge in 66 and Pate probably in 68 or 9, still with me. We're partners in some of the horses. And some other people for a good long period of time. Horses, you know, you think of obviously the ones that... I love horses. I don't really particularly... I think almost to the point that I think it drags me down a little bit. Sometimes I spend too much time with the cheap horses that are never going to amount to much, just because I feel it's my duty and a challenge to try to get the best out of them, even if it's at a low level. So I sort of feel some camaraderie towards even the lesser ones in the stable. And then the good ones is great, but they, you know, God made them faster horses. It's not necessary that, perhaps that they tried harder or, you know, or I did a better job of them. It's just that, that they were naturally more gifted.
Yeah.
So, you know, it has been a long time, and it's been so many horses and so many good owners and so many good people working for me, and it's been ups and downs. You know, you can't get too high on yourself in this game because it's very humbling. You know, you're on top for a while and then a good horse gets hurt or one of your best prospects doesn't pan out the way you hoped. And I'm always sort of, I guess one of my mottos is hope for the best, but be prepared for the worst because you know it's going to be around the corner.
Yeah, in this game, it is the highest highs and the lowest lows.
Sure,
and you have been through all of them.
But I kind of thrive off that. And I think you have to be able to stay in the game. You know, if you just want a steady 9-to-5 job working in an office every day, the same routine day after day after day, you're never going to hit the heights and you're never going to hit the lows. You're going to be nice and safe and secure, but you never really accomplish that much. So I rather enjoy living on the edge a little bit. I think it seems to suit my personality.
Yeah, only about 1 minute left here, Jonathan. This hour has really, truthfully flown by. What is it now, with all the success you've had, with all the winners you've trained, what is it now that still drives you to get up in the mornings and get to the barn?
I guess just the natural competitiveness. And I feel one of the things I'm most proud of is to have been, as I mentioned earlier, consistent at a relatively high level. And I would hope that that doesn't change. You know, I sometimes see older people that have sort of seemed like they'd lost their drive and motivation a little bit, just sort of going through the motions. And I think if I reach that stage, I would actually rather pack it in than keep going. I want to keep doing well or not do it at all.
And well, Jonathan Shepherd, our special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. We could spend a whole nother hour talking with you, Jonathan. It was an absolute delight to hear your story. All the best moving forward. I know your career is far from over, and all the best, my friend.
I appreciate it. Nice talking with you. Sorry if I rambled too long. We didn't have a chance to get it all in.
That's wonderful. Jonathan Shepherd here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Don't forget, if you missed any portion of that amazing story, you can go back to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out a podcast. It's available for you at your leisure, all at horseracingradio.net. Wow, wonderful story. Jonathan Shepherd, somebody who has overcome so much personally and professionally, and he is at the top of his game. Class act and a great ambassador for the sport. For my producer, Lee Delapina, I am Mike Penn, and we'll talk to you next time on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton. Thanks for listening.